Can I have some? Here we go. So there's actually not so many people today. So today is this just for the special people. Special people. So we always go for quality, not quantity. So for today's sutta classes, now 3 o'clock. This was a couple of suttas suggested by John. He wanted me to talk about, and it's all to do about lay people and being a stream winner. So I will teach this and see how we go. Are you ready there in the sound thing? Ready to go? Okay. Just a couple of latecomers coming in. There we go. There you go.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi.
So today's sutta is from the Anguttara Nikaya, and if you don't know that section of the Sutta Pitaka, that is where all of the teachings are arranged in according to numbers. And in this particular one, the Book of the Fives, the first one, they put it in the Book of the Fives because they have the five qualities of the stream winner. And it's also mentioned about, in the next one, about other qualities of a stream winner, and that is from the Book of the Eights. So here we go to the first one. There's still a couple of people coming in, so I'll just wait for a little bit longer. And there's some interesting points that are going to be made in this sutta. And as we make them, we can discuss them if you have any doubts or questions. Very good. So we're ready to go. So the first one is called a layman, and of course when it means a layman, it says a layman here, it means a lay person. Unfortunately, 2 weeks ago I had the chance to retranslate the sutta, but this time I did not. So this is straight from the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which was also edited by Ajahn Bhamani. So then the householder Anathapindika, and if you remember, Anathapindika was a very rich merchant, and he was the one who bought the Jeta Grove Monastery from Prince Jeta and offered it to the Sangha, and that became the famous monastery where the Buddha spent most of his teaching career. So then the householder Anathapindika, accompanied by 500 lay followers. In other words, he had a lot of lay followers, and I think that's probably because he was rich. I remember going to be invited to a Katina ceremony by a very rich man over in Indonesia. And I was wondering why he was inviting me, because he was a Buddhist. Everybody who worked for his company had to come to the Katina ceremony, otherwise they'd lose their jobs. So there's about 500 there as well. So this is quite possible. Accompanied by 500 lay followers, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. And then the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, addressed Venerable Sariputta. You should know, Sariputta, that any white-robed householder whose actions are restrained by 5 training rules, who gains at will without trouble or difficulty 4 pleasant visible dwellings that pertain to the high mind, might, if he so wished, declare of himself, I am finished with hell, the animal realm, the sphere of ghosts, afflicted spirits, I am finished with the plane of misery, bad destinations, the lower world. I am a stream enterer, no longer subject to rebirth in the lower world, fixed in destiny, heading for enlightenment. Now, just to say a few things about that. So first of all, the white robe lay disciples, it was seemed to be common in those days in India that if you embarked upon a spiritual life but still living in home, then you would go around wearing the white clothes, the white robes. And you still see that when people come to the monastery to stay overnight, especially when they're keeping eight precepts, they usually wear white as a symbol of the purity. And you don't see that, well, you still see people wearing white when they come, say, here for the eight precepts, and sometimes when they come to the temples, they wear white. You still see that in Sri Lanka, when the children come to the Dharma school, they always dress them in white. And you even see that in Muslim countries, when they go to the mosque, they always usually wear white. This actually came in from Buddhism and the practice in India, wearing white. And I suppose the only place we can see that these days is when you have weddings, because in weddings, the wife or the bride always wears white as a symbol of purity. And the groom always wears black as a symbol of you know what. I never said anything. Anyway, so they were white robed lay followers, and now they, having said the beginning, five training rules, and an interesting part is, again, at will without trouble or difficulty, four pleasant visible dwellings that pertain to the high mind. That is often mentioned with a different explanation, so it's fascinating that that particular phrase is applied in a different way in this sutta. And they declare themselves finished with hell, animal realm, the sphere of afflicted spirits, finished with the pain and misery, bad destination, the lower world. I'm a stream enterer. And you may know, I hope you know, that the four stages of enlightenment, being a stream winner, and once returner, non-returner, fully enlightened arahat. Four stages of development along the path towards enlightenment. That's the first one. And if you are a stream winner, it is you cannot get reborn in the lower realms. So it's only the human realm or the heavenly realms for you once you become a stream winner. And because that is so, that many, many Buddhists, they read this and they think, well, that's the very least I should be able to do in this lifetime, to become a stream winner, so I don't need to go to any lower realms again, so that I am destined for enlightenment within how many more lifetimes? If you are a stream winner, you know the answer to this, Nicholas, so be quiet. How many more lifetimes, how many more births do you have if you're a stream winner in this life? It's a trick question. Always keep quiet with the trick questions. It is six more births. Because in the way it's counted in Asia, that this life is number one. So you die here and you get reborn and your next life is number two. So six more rebirths. It's the same in Asia, you know, that you may be, like I'm 64 years of age, but in Asia I'm 65 already. You always had an extra year, because when you're born you're already one. It's your first year. So that's just a different way of counting. So when it says you only have seven more lives, that counts this one as number one. The next one is number two. Anyway, what are the five training rules by which his actions are restrained? Here, Sariputta, a noble disciple abstains from the destruction of life, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from liquor, wine, and intoxicants, the basis of heedlessness. His actions are restrained by these five training rules. That's the five precepts. Does that mean a stream winner cannot break the five precepts? It's another trick question, because the answer is again no. And this makes a very powerful point here, what it means by being restrained. In other words, that your actions, they do just have a guide to them. And if you do break these things, you know you've broken them, and you can't hide those breaks. You're still training, you're trying to do your best. Because there was another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, Sarakan, it's also in the Sangyutta Nikaya, where there was one man, and after he died, he was a very devout disciple of the Buddha, And when he died, they asked him, you know, where's he gone? Because if there was a devout disciple of the Buddha, he used to go and get drunk. You know, he's a bit of an alcoholic. And the Buddha said, well, he was actually a stream winner. And as soon as the Buddha declared that this man, who was an alcoholic, was a stream winner when he died, people went around saying, oh, these days, anyone can be a stream winner. In the early days, you know, you had to really be good, but now even alcoholics can become stream winners. And they asked him, the Buddha, and the Buddha actually confirmed, yes, he was a stream winner. Because even though he had that fault, he was trying his best, but he had incredible faith in the Buddha, and he would have seen his faults, especially at his death. So he was a stream winner. So the five precepts become your guide, but, you know, you are restrained by them. You're trying to do your best. You're not being heedless in the sense you don't care about them. And the next one here, the four pleasant visible dwellings that pertain to the high mind, which you gain at will without trouble or difficulty. Now, it seems everywhere else in the suttas, when they make that statement, it always refers to four jhanas. But here, it refers to something else, which is quite noteworthy. So instead of the jhanas, they have these ones instead. So here, the noble disciple possesses unwavering confidence in the Buddha. Thus, the Blessed One is an arahant, fully enlightened. So obviously, that, you know, if you have faith in the teacher, you know, your faith is that they are totally enlightened, perfectly enlightened, accomplished not just in the knowledge, but in the conduct. They got here fortunate, that's not such a great translation. Knower of the worlds. Knower of the world does not mean that, you know everything that Google Maps knows and more. It means like more the world of the mind, the world. It actually should be knower of the worlds. Really, not knower of the worlds. The worlds of just the hell realms, heaven realms, and the realms of the mind. In Buddhism, they always say there's three realms, three worlds. It's what they call Kamaloka, the world where you have the five senses, or four senses sometimes. And these are, you know, realms of feeling, seeing, hearing, tasting, touch. Even in the lower realms, you still have those same five senses. And in the higher realms, these are just the realms of the jhana, the rupa loka and the arupa loka, where there's purely mind-made realms. Mind-made realms and perception-made realms. Three different lokas, they call, three different worlds of existence. And that's important in one sense for people to understand in the bigger picture of Buddhism. Because people often ask, well, when this physical world disappears, you know, when the universe ends and before another universe starts to evolve, now where do people go? They've got no place to get reborn into. And the Buddha always says they go into this one of these other two realms of existences, Rupa Loka or Arupa Loka. So this world of universe is not just the only realm of existence. They've got the mind-made realms as well. So when it says the Buddha is the knower of the worlds, should be S there, it means that not just this human realm, heaven realms, hell realms, and also these realms of the mind. And the next one, if you're ever a teacher, it's a wonderful one to understand. Unsurpassed trainer of persons to be tamed. And the Buddha points out that some people are not fit to be tamed, that no one can train them. They're totally wild. So of those people who can be trained, the Buddha is the best trainer of them. Always understand that some people, it's impossible. And that's always a wonderful thing if ever you're an abbot or a teacher, to know that if some sort of monks or nuns, they disrobe, they go a bit crazy, it's not my fault. Because even the Buddha, there's some people just cannot be trained. It's not my fault. So this is a trainer of those who are able to be trained. And teacher of devas and humans, and I love that one, of literally gods and human beings. It was Deva Manusanang. Because I mentioned this recently when I was in Penang. There was a monk, many of you may know him, Dr. Kesari Dharmananda, who passed away a couple of years ago. And he had also a very good sense of humor. And I used to tell him a few stories. He used to tell me a lot back. And once, you know, we were talking about people who were trying to convert the Buddhists in Malaysia to Christianity. And one of their ways of trying to be cheeky and trying to convert them is said, oh, you're Buddha. He wasn't even a son of God. He was just an ordinary person. You know, Jesus was a son of God. And then I said, well, I told Dr. Casey Nam, I said, no, you tell your disciples to say that our Buddha was a teacher of your Jesus' father. Teacher of gods and men. Okay, that's being cheeky. I don't do that, you know, to my friends who are Christians. It's only those who try to be cheeky back to me. So he thought that was very funny. He said, oh, I'm going to tell people that. To say that, you know, if they say that our Buddha was nobody. Oh, no, Buddha was your prophet's father's teacher. So you should respect him. Because this is Chinese culture, and you always respect your teachers, especially your dad's teacher. So anyway, it's just being cheeky. But teacher of gods and men and humans. The enlightened one, the blessed one. This is the first pleasant visible dwelling that pertains to the high mind, which he has achieved for the purification of the impure mind, for the cleansing of the unclean mind. So this is actually basically faith. And they all say it's unshakable faith. You know, the Buddha was actually enlightened. An enlightened being. Yes. A visible dwelling, actually, it is a dwelling experience. I'm bring this up in the next paragraph here. It's a dwelling experience now in this life. Because you can understand with religions like Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, there's very much about having your beliefs confirmed after death. That when you get to heaven, after you die, then you'll have all your beliefs confirmed. And they try and look at their holy books to confirm this must be right, so because we can't see what happens after death yet, but, you know, we trust in our books, but we can't really know for sure until after death. And the opposite of that is where it says visible. Sometimes they call it visible here and now. It literally does mean be able to be experienced in this life. You can know for yourself now before you die. Which is an important distinction between Buddhism and other religions. It means you don't have to just have faith. You can confirm these things in this life. And of course, you know, through meditation is one of the best ways of doing that. So this is a faith in the fact that Buddha was a teacher. And of course, from that, the Buddha was enlightened. Then the teachings which he gave have that extra importance and value. So again, the noble disciple possesses unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. This is actually Suakato. And I like to say that it's even much better than that. It's that the Dhamma is like perfectly expounded. So as the Buddha expounded the Dhamma, you know, that is not just what he says, but how he says it. It's just so well put. And I think I mentioned maybe to the monks, I'm not sure if to the lay community, sometimes when you have experiences, you know, in meditation or in insight, and, you know, you're going into very deep realms of meditation, and they're very, very hard to explain to people. And any of you who've had some meditation experiences are always struggling to find the words to describe it. And that's why then you look into these teachings of the Buddha recorded in the suttas, which is the best we have to know what the Buddha actually taught. And sometimes it's really sort of goosebump raising. You read what the Buddha said, and he puts it in such beautiful words. You know, it's not just his ability to know these things, but to describe them in such a beautiful way, in an accurate way. So whenever you do have any experiences in deep insight or in meditation, you go and look these things up in the books. Wow, you know, that Buddha certainly not only knew what he was talking about, but could explain it so well. It was like the gift of being able to explain something. So this is why it's called well expounded by the Blessed One, really well described. And it's directly visible here. This is that word sanditiko. And if you've ever been to any of my classes over in Bodhinyana for the rains retreat. You know that as I pick up, there is, I think, the Mahadukka Kanda Sutta, could be wrong which the sutta is, but in one of those sutras, it's very clear what this word, here translated as directly visible, means, because it's contrasted with another word. Have sanditika, that's the word here, directly visible, and the other word is samparayika. And in this particular context, in the sutta which I'm referring to, they're talking about the results of, like, say, bad karma and good karma. You know, if a person does bad karma in this life, they, you know, sometimes they go to jail, sometimes they get punished, sometimes they lose all their wealth and their friends criticize them because of the bad karma they've done in this life. And they say that is sanditika, visible in this life, as opposed to in the next life they get reborn in a bad situation, maybe in a hell realm as a ghost or something because of their bad karma. That's the samparayika, that's the results in a future life. So if you do good karma in this life, you have a lot of friends, people trust you, even good health because you don't worry so much about the bad stuff you've done. That's the results of good karma in this life. And of course in the next life, going to a good destination, a heaven realm. That's the samparayika. So what it actually means here, directly visible, it's very clear, it does mean it's experience in this life. You don't have to wait until after death to find out if these teachings are true or not. You can test them out, penetrate them, know them as fact in this life. Again, through the practice, the training. Immediate, yeah, that's akalika. Again, akalika means nothing to do with time. And I prefer there that basically what it says, timeless. Not immediate, but timeless. And to understand that, 25 centuries later on, still the same things apply. If you start letting go, the mind gets peaceful and still. The way of meditation works. The psychology, 2500 years, applies today, as we now know, with universities teaching Buddhist psychology, teaching mindfulness, 2500 years old, but it's timeless in the fact that it works. So when it says immediately, timeless. Inviting one to come and see, that is the ahipassiko, which means not telling you to believe, but tell you to come and question, come and investigate. And it's not one of these teachings where you have to believe or you get punished or you get killed for asking a question, that you're allowed and encouraged to ask questions. I know that sometimes it's a bit of a pain as a teacher to have so many questions. And sometimes whenever I used to go visit New Norcia Monastery, the Benedictine Catholics, there they have this rule of obedience. Whatever the abbot says, you have to believe in. And sometimes I often go there and I get come back with longing. Oh, maybe I joined the wrong tradition. But no, I'd rather have the questioning than just the blind belief. But it has a certain attraction to it if you're an abbot. But no, it's inviting you to come and see, to question. And applicable, it's opanayika. And it means like leading onwards. You know, it actually, once you get so far, it opens the door to another great insight, another great experience. Once you understand one level, it does actually automatically go into something new. So this is a way, it's a gradual training which leads on and on and on all the way to enlightenment. Not something sudden, you just accept it and that's it. But it's a gradual opening of the mind to wisdom, compassion and peace. And inviting one to come and see, that's always the very nice one. It's not telling you to come and see, not out of fear, not out of compulsion, but just it's there for you to investigate whenever you want. If you don't want to, you don't have to. I don't keep a record of people who come on a Friday night, and if you haven't been on a Friday night for 3 nights, I don't come and ring you up and say, where have you been, Barbara? 3 nights you haven't been here. Was it like that person who the priest, I mean, a couple of jokes here, a priest described his congregation like the army of Christ, and that the I don't know if you went to church before, you may have heard that before, the army of Christ. And he asked one of the people, said, "I haven't seen you in church all year. The only time you ever come, you know, is in on Easter time." He said, "You're supposed to be in the army of Christ." He said, "I'm in the army of Christ. I'm in the secret service." That's a nice little joke there for you. But this is, no, it's not sort of forcing a person to go to the temple. It's just inviting you. And just, this is, to me, that was actually wonderful. To see, here is Buddhism. He said, "You can come if you want. You don't have to if you don't want to." And that was actually great marketing, you know, for a rebellious young teenager. So inviting you to come and see, applicable to all parts of your life, not just the meditation, and to be personally experienced by the wise. So this is something which you experience, this Dhamma, and it's something which you don't learn and remember and believe in. That's actually part of it. In the second sutta, we actually go through the different stages of understanding. But first of all, you get a good background of what the Dhamma is. You get some sort of idea of the map of the Dhamma, but it's not just learning the map. You have to go to the territory and go and experience these things yourself. Every one of these things, even things like jhanas, great insights, stream winnings, that's for you to experience, not you just to believe in. So it's not a faith-based tradition, although faith has a part to it. It goes much further than that. It's to be experienced. Everyone for themselves. And this is the second present visible dwelling that pertains to the higher mind, which he has achieved, or she has achieved, the purification of the impure mind for the cleansing of the unclean mind. So this unwavering confidence that, you know, what the Buddha said actually works. And one of those confidences is that the Buddha said, unless you are one of these people who have murdered, deliberately killed your mother or father, if you are a person who has shed the blood of a Buddha, caused a schism in the Sangha, sexually violated a bhikkhuni, what's the other ones? Then that, they call them abhapuggalas. It's only these people are the only ones who are not able to get enlightened. Everybody else is. So sometimes when people ask me that question, they said, you know, can people get enlightened these days? And they said, can I get enlightened these days? And I said, well, have you killed your mum and dad? And said, no. Have you caused the Buddha to shed blood? No. Have you, they said, have you raped one of the nuns? No. Said, well, then you can become bigger, then you can become enlightened. And I'm just repeating what the Buddha said. So it is actually the faith that you can do it, each one of you. Even you, Baba. Indeed, then it's not intentional. So there's no problem there. All karma has to be intentional. You have to mean it. And even though that this is, by the way, but some people have this terrible situation. Your mum is in the ICU, in a coma, and the doctor tells you, can I turn off the machine, please? And for a lot of people who know this, they think, oh my goodness, that's my mum. If I tell him to turn it off, I've killed my mum. Therefore, I can't become enlightened. Now, the point is that you are not killing your mum by that time. Your mum's already gone. She's dead. She left. And that's not hard for people to know. And I often say this, the same idea as, or similar idea than when you've got that pet who's very sick and the doctor says, can I give it the injection to euthanize it? But with her mum, it's a little bit more refined. You sit by her bed and just ask, are you still there, mum? You still there? If that's your mother and you've got a little bit of sensitivity, you know, you've been meditating for a while, you should do that easily. You'll be able to feel. There's no one there. It's gone. Or you can actually feel, yeah, she's still there. And if she's still there, no, keep her going. But if she's gone, then you're not killing her. It's just an empty body, an empty shell, just being kept alive by the machines. Or it looks like it's alive. But the person stream of consciousness has already left. It's not a hard thing to know. So that's what I usually tell people, that having mentioned that to kill your father or mother intentionally is, you know, one of the worst karmas according to the Buddha, then to overcome that difficulty when you're asked to turn off the machine or permission to turn off the machines, that's what you have to do. You know, you have to just feel, is she there, is she not there? And you'll know that. It's an amazing, actually, experience. You know, just, they're not there anymore, it's empty. And then you're not killing them. You're just letting the body just stop. Yeah. Sorry, this one, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Myself and I was just within the hospital with the father, and they said to me, if you are passing away, then you have to put something down your throat, and then your lungs die, and you'll probably break your ribs.
Yeah.
And Dad said that I don't have anything to put down my throat.
Yeah, okay.
I explained to him that you would have to have it or you would have to have
it. Yeah. Yeah. The end.
So, with our father, we had to come to a decision that we had to make a decision whether or not we were there to give in CPR or not. That decision was put upon us.
Ah, but yes, but this is... Yeah. This is non-action. This is not doing something. So that doesn't really count as knowing karma. Karma is an act of body or speech. So what you were doing there, you were just saying, no, just let the nature take its course. Not put anything down your father's throat. Even though you knew that would actually cause the death, but it's your father's will, not your will. And so there's no problem there at all. Now, when it says killing your mother or father, it really does mean taking a gun and shooting them or something.
It just feels like
you're giving them permission. You're giving them permission to not. It's not really giving. It's not you giving permission. You're doing that out of respect for your father. You know, you're doing that. You're conveying that person's wishes to somebody else. That is the argument which I often use when, say, a dog. He's very sick. You take him to the vet. And as far as I'm concerned, it's not your responsibility. It's not right that you tell that dog, tell the vet, kill that dog, keep it alive. It's not your call. It's the dog's choice. So in order to get the dog's choice, you ask the dog. Yeah. Yeah. Time. That's right, yeah. So it's the dog's call. Same as your father's call. Okay, so you're talking about a father who was very, very sick, said he didn't want a very painful intervention towards the end, and you conveyed that message to the doctors. That is not called intentional killing. So you're fine there. You can still become enlightened. Yes, Lynn. Oh yeah, just in this life, yes. So that if you've shed the blood of a Buddha like Devadatta is supposed to have done, it means you couldn't become enlightened in that life, but the Buddha said, oh, he will certainly become enlightened later on in another lifetime. So it's only a life sentence, it's not a many life sentence. So it's an interesting, but the point is there that it does mean that the number of people who do those things are just so tiny. Which means every one of you can become enlightened. It doesn't say that you know, if you're gay, lesbian, transgender, you can't get enlightened. It doesn't mention that. A woman doesn't mention that you have to be this race or that race, this age or that age, and get degrees or don't have any degrees. It doesn't say that at all. So everybody can be. So that's one of the wonderful things about the understanding this. It's a pleasant visible dwelling in this life to know that you can do this. And there's no obstacle for you. It's just whether you do do it or you don't do it. And that gives you unwavering confidence this Dharma actually works. And again, the noble disciple possesses unwavering confidence in the Sangha. Here we go. Thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is practicing the good way, the straight way, the true way, the proper way. And there's no real difference between those four things. Those are just the synonyms. No one's ever really been able to convince me or others that there's any difference there. And of course, I've mentioned to you before in these sutta classes that it's just the nature of the Pali language that when you can say things four times instead of once, you usually say them five times, just to make it a big picture rather than just one word. So Pali sometimes is not as precise as English. So that is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individuals. And those four types of persons, eight types of individuals, the four types of people are the stream winner, the once returner, the non-returner, and the fully enlightened arahat, divided into two, those on the path to being a stream winner, those who have achieved being a stream winner, those who are on the path to being a once returner, those who achieved once returning, those on the path to being a non-returner, those who have achieved non-returning, those who are on the path to enlightenment and has achieved full enlightenment. Those are called the eight types of people. And of those eight types of people, the only pairing which is fully described by the Buddha is those on the path to being a stream winner and those who have achieved stream winning. The other three pairs, that it's so difficult to understand, you know, how you can actually distinguish, say, one who is a non-returner and one who is on the path of being fully enlightened. So, but where it does make a difference is on this first pairing, those on the path of being a stream winner and those who have achieved stream winning. And that is a point I'm going to bring up later on at the end of this sutta. So the eight types of individuals. The Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples is worthy of gifts, worthy of hospitality, worthy of offerings, worthy of reverential salutation. Now, this is called the Sangha, and you may have come across the phenomena starting in places like the United States, still strong in a city like Sydney, of calling any lay group a Sangha. So in Sydney you have like the Blue Gum Sangha. In San Francisco you have the gay, lesbian, transgender Sangha. And a lot of people like myself, even Bhikkhu Bodhi as well, said that's really not the appropriate use of the word Sangha. And this is what I quote here, because the Sangha, they're supposed to be worthy of gifts, hospitality of offerings, reverential salutations, and that was always meaning the monastic Sangha. Now there is even a rule for us that, you know, even if, you know, you were fully enlightened, then, you know, I would not be able to sort of bow down to you, because that's our Vinaya rules. And that even happened many times. There was lay people who were highly evolved anagamis, and they would still pay a reverential salutation to a member of the monastic community. Exactly. So this is what happened then. So I use this argument, you know, and people accept it. When it mentions the word Sangha, that always means the monks, the nuns in brown or one of the other colours. That is the Sangha. And it is a little bit dangerous, even actually mischievous, actually, to call a group of lay people Sangha, because then their triple gem becomes any old group of people. And they call them the Sangha. The Sangha in the time of the Buddha and in every Asian country always means the monastics, not any lay people. Of course, there's the four groups, the laymen, laywomen, nuns and monks. They're called parisa. They give it a different name. Assemblies, they say, gatherings together. But the Buddha never used the word Sangha for any group of lay people. Now we have something called the Arya Sangha. And the Arya Sangha means the Sangha of Noble Ones. But the Arya Sangha of Noble Ones, that's actually what they're really saying over here, is those who are stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats. They are like a subset of the monastic Sangha. So the monastic Sangha, all the monks and nuns in the world forever, only a small number of those are enlightened ones. But if you're enlightened outside the Sangha, which is quite possible, if you're a stream winner, once return, non-return, or whatever, then yes, you're Aryan, but you're not Arya Sangha. Can an enlightened layperson? Of course. Of course they can, yeah. And in fact, you may have heard this before, and it's actually, I understand this is true. My own experience is that if you become fully enlightened then, an arahat, then you have to become a bhikkhuni within 7 days. Otherwise you die. She said, oh, rubbish. Now, you may say that, but actually, it's true. And the reason is because the nature of your will, there's no reason for you to keep on going. If you actually seen that Dhamma and practiced it to its ultimate, and really got into non-self, and seen the nature of this will, it's not up to you anymore. The only reason for existing, if you're fully enlightened, is to be able to teach the Dhamma or to be an unsurpassed field of merit. And basically, you lose your will to live. Yeah, but that just happens, whether you like it or not. Anyway, that's an interesting point. That's why usually if a person does become enlightened, usually just try and ordain them straight away. You get fast-tracked. And no matter what Venerable Ayahasapanya says, you have to be fast-tracked. okay, whatever. Anyway, let's go back to what we're supposed to be talking about. So that's the faith in the Sangha. Oh, they said I haven't finished it yet. The unsurpassed field of merit for the world. And I also like to mention the unsurpassed field of merit for the world. That's the biggest bang for your bucks of donations of food and whatever. And they always say the biggest bang for your bucks. You're very lucky here in Perth because most countries they can't do this, is to give a gift to both sanghas of monastics, male and females, bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. And still in many places in the world they haven't got their bhikkhunis yet. We here in Perth are one of the first. You start to be very proud of that because you have the opportunity now to give gifts to both sanghas. And you can do that next Sunday, a week today, at Dharamsala. And, people don't realize that this is, the Buddha said, the biggest good karma you can ever make. That was just what the Buddha was saying for the equity, just not just monks, not even just nuns, but both together in living in peace and harmony. That's the highest, unsurpassed field of merit for the world. This is the third pleasant visible dwelling that pertains to the higher mind, which you have achieved for the purification of the impure mind, for the cleansing of the unclean mind. And lastly, the number five, the noble disciple possesses the virtuous behavior loved by other noble ones, unbroken, flawless, unblemished, unblotched, freeing, praised by the wise. Praised by the wise. Ungrasped, leading to stillness. Now, what was the word for ungrasped? I should have got my Pali out here, I'm not quite sure, but ungrasped, obviously, that these are not things you are doing through force. These are your natural virtuous behavior. Because if you try to be virtuous, if you put on the act of trying to be a goody-goody, sooner or later it falls apart. You get caught out. And you can't maintain sort of a fallacy for too long. So when it's unglass, it means it's your natural goodness, your natural virtue. So it's not something which you just have to be so mindful of and so afraid you're going to make a mistake. Your virtue becomes unglassed, unforced, natural. I would probably prefer to put unforced there. Leading to stillness. Because virtue is one of the causes of stillness. I've mentioned this, sometimes you come to the meditation and, yeah, you watch the breath, you follow all the instructions, but it still doesn't work. One of the reasons why is maybe someone has done something bad today. They were shouted at their wife, or they didn't put the right amount in their tax return. Or that those things actually have an effect on your mind. You may not see it, but it does have an effect. It makes the mind less pure. This is the fourth pleasant visible dwelling that pertains to the higher mind, which has achieved for the purification of the impure mind, for the cleansing of the unclean mind. In a moment. These are the four pleasant visible dwellings that pertain to the higher mind, which you gain at will without trouble or difficulty. So instead of the four jhanas, you have unshakable faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and your natural virtue. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Indeed. So flawless, the meaning of flawless is, now you can keep it so that Rene doesn't need to keep running around. So keep it there, put it down, and then when another questioner asks, you can actually take it to the next questioner. So you have to keep your mind on that machine over in the corner over there. So it is flawless in the sense you're allowed to make a mistake, but you admit the mistake and you grow from the mistake. So another example of this wonderful idea in Buddhism is perfection is not doing everything right. But perfection is actually whenever you do make a mistake, no punishing, learn from it, grow, do better next time.
I suppose a stream winner with like perfect few wouldn't take on any aspect of guilt.
Indeed. Now that's something coming up in a few moments. When we get towards the end of this sutta, because I think this is maybe why John asked for this sutta to be read out, but I'll just finish it first of all before going over it. Oh, you got something? Yeah.
I find that by just the simple chanting of Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.
Yeah.
No, that's power in it.
There is power in it.
Difficulty, it does work.
Yeah, there is power in it. But that power is more coming from your faith than in the words. Because somebody else, a parrot, could chant Buddhang Saranangacchami, Dhammang Saranangacchami. And because, you know, they don't understand what they're talking about, they don't have a deep understanding, then the power is very, very limited.
Okay. By the power, I mean the power of just like with chanting. Say, for example, you meet a difficult person, okay?
Yeah.
And then you get some problem again. So you do the chanting. It's like, you know, like the negative force from the person goes away.
It goes away from you, but yeah. It still stays in that person. It doesn't change them.
So it eases the problem.
Yeah.
That's why I find it.
Yeah, can do. Okay, I'll just keep going here and finish the sutra, and I'll just say a few words about it. You should know, Sariputta, that any white-robed householder whose actions are restrained by these five training rules, and who gains at will without trouble or difficulty these four pleasant visible dwellings that pertain to the higher mind, might, if he so wished, declare of himself, I am finished with hell, the animal realm, the sphere of reflected spirits. I am finished with the plane of misery, the bad destination, the lower world. I am a stream enterer, no longer subject to rebirth in the lower world, fixed in destiny, heading for enlightenment. So, at first glance, when you look at this sutta out of context with all the other suttas, all you need to do to become a stream winner and to declare to others you are a stream winner is to be able to keep the five precepts and to have unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, and have this beautiful virtue. And if you can tick those boxes, then you can say to other people, you're a stream winner. And then you say, well, what about all the other stuff which we're supposed to do, like being able to meditate and being able to understand things like anicca, dukkha, anatta? They're not even mentioned in this. All you need to do is to be able to keep the five precepts and have great confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and just have good virtue. But the problem always comes when we take one sutta out of context with everywhere else. So you put in the other suttas. And the other suttas, the one which I'm going to quote now, is a Chulavedala Sutta, where they ask, what is the cause for becoming a stream winner? And that is where the Buddha actually says that there's two causes, and the one is paratagosa, and that word actually means it's the teachings from others, from other Aryans, other people who have understood the Dhamma. You need to actually to have that brainwashing, that influence from other enlightened beings. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, when they say something about a transmission, there's actually there is something there. They take it far too complicated. But you know, the Dhamma being transmitted from someone who's seen the Dhamma to others who haven't seen it. And the other one is the work of the mind which goes back to the source, the Yoni Samanisikara. And that is, always will be, the meditation, going deep, deep into the whys. Why? You know, where are, you know, who are you? What are you? What do you take yourself to be? So, in order to be able to have such unwavering confidence in the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, you have to have experienced some of those things which the Buddha have experienced, to know that what he said was actually true. You cannot get unwavering confidence just by reading or by listening, just no matter how powerful that teacher is. Even the Buddha, great powerful teacher, could sometimes not convince people. But one of the answers is, because why what doesn't say anything about being a meditating or getting jhanas or penetrating a non-self? So how can you say you're a stream winner? And here, John, this happens so often that the answer comes, you know, what do you actually need to become a stream winner? I already mentioned you need the teachings of another Aryan, and you also need the deep meditation to go to the source of things. So really, do you need something like a jhana to become fully enlightened? That becomes sort of a stream winner. And people ask, and the story which I like telling people, the one time which was the most weird time when a person's become a stream winner, was when that time when Devadatta and King Ajatasattu were trying to kill the Buddha. And the one thing they did, they hired an assassin, you know, to go and kill the Buddha. And they also hired two assassins to kill the assassin. And four more assassins to kill the two assassins. And eight assassins to kill the four, and 16 assassins to kill the eight, thereby trying to destroy any trace of culpability. And that was actually the plan they put down there. And so the first assassin went to go and kill the Buddha, and as soon as he came up to the Buddha was just so soft and sweet. You know, there's some people you just can't harm. And he's saying, no, you know, you're too soft and sweet and kind. You know, it's like even, imagine trying to kill a baby seal, but 100 times more than that. Ugh. And so, the Buddha's compassion and softness and kindness meant that he could not be killed. So the assassin felt really guilty and just confessed, I came here to kill you. I did a terrible thing, but you know, that's just a thought. He never went through with it. So the Buddha forgave him, and the Buddha taught him Dhamma. And according to the text, this person became a stream winner. And no sort of faith in anything else. Of course, the Buddhas gave him a quick talk. No meditation. A bad guy, a hired assassin. Just a little talk from the Buddha, became a stream winner. If that wasn't weird enough, the Buddha said, look, there's two other assassins coming to kill you. They're coming this way, so you go the other way. So he helped this assassin escape. And these other two came looking for this assassin. They came to the Buddha, you've seen this guy, and was said, come over here. I know you were trying to kill him because he was trying to kill me. the Buddha gave the Dhamma to these two assassins, and they gave up their bad ideas, and they also became stream winners. And then the four looking for the two got lost, and they found the Buddha, and the Buddha did the same to them, another four stream winners. Then the eight, and then the 16 too. And these were people with a mind coming into the jungle to kill people. Paid assassins. And the Buddha taught them down, they became stream winners. How on earth is that possible? And the answer is that in Buddhism, in the Dhamma, in the Pali, they make very little distinctions between a stream winner and a stream enterer, those two paths. And the reason is because once you have entered the path of being a stream winner, you've entered the path, then you have to get the fruits, the final realization of being a stream winner before you die. And that's one of the unwritten laws, like the laws of physics. Not what you choose, but you have to. So if you see enough to become a stream enterer, then stream winning is so sure for you that very often they say, well, you are a stream winner already. Even though technically you're not, your stream winning is certain. And the closest metaphor we have to that today is, suppose that you cheat, say, a bikie, and the bikie tells you, Ainsley, you're dead, because you cheated a bikie today. Maybe when you were coming up here today, your car just scraped his Harley Davidson, and he shouts to the window, man, you're dead. And it doesn't mean you're dead, you're still alive, you're still walking. What he means is, you're dead because your death is certain. Now, I hope you never did that today, Ainsley, but this is just a metaphor, so you don't need to be worried. But we do actually say that when your death is certain, they say you're tantamount to being dead. And that metaphor is very common in Pali. If it's certain, sometimes it's like it's already happened. So very often, and this is one case of those assassins, it's very, very difficult, and I don't think anyone would agree that they were entered, they had achieved stream winning just by listening to the Buddha. But they would certainly become stream enterers. Their faith would be so strong. And here we go into the two types of people on the path of being a stream winner. This is from other suttas. They call them the one who fares according to Dhamma, the one who fares according to faith. Sadanusari and Dhammanusari. The Sadanusari has got so much faith in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, that whatever the Buddha basically says, five precepts, I'm going to keep those. So much faith, if this is what the Buddha taught, it must be right. These are the Sangha which the Buddha establishes, the monastic communities, then I'm going to have trust in them as well. And if this is what the Buddha wanted me to do as a virtuous person, this is what I'm going to do. If your faith is that strong, then of course you're going to follow that path which the Buddha put down. There's going to be no wavering because of the power of that faith. You're going to just do it, which means you're sure to actually get to the results in the end. That's called a faith follower. And the other one, a Dhamma farer, is one who's, you've listened to enough, you haven't fully penetrated, but what you've actually understood and experienced yourself is enough to give you a taste that yes, you understand this Dhamma. You've experienced enough that your faith is solid. And you're actually going to eventually just make that last little journey. Of course, those to the fruit of stream winning. So, those are the two types of people on the path of being a stream winner. People have heard enough, they've got enough confidence, faith, or experience. And it's not just really one of the two. Some people are mostly faith, a little bit of experience. Mostly experience, a little bit of faith. But the two actually work together. Those are the people on the path of being a stream winner. And I will impress you by saying that most of you are on that path. You've heard enough really good teaching, you've had enough experience. You know, you're in this now, and you're going to go to the end. So, you know, being on the path of being a stream mentor. But you're not there yet. So, and that's the same with these people here, the assassins. They had so much faith, and what happened? They're going to carry on from here on in, and they're going to do the Eightfold Path. They're going to keep all the precepts. They're going to have right speech and right action, right livelihood. They're going to sort of put forth the effort, be mindful, and get into the deep meditations and experience some Dhamma. Yes, Baba. Ah, yeah. Yeah, indeed. But over here, I will, indeed, that this Sangha which you're supposed to have faith in over here, if you put it, read it out again, where's it gone? The noble disciple says his unwavering confidence in Sangha thus, the Sangha of the Blessed One's disciples practicing the good way, the straight way, the true way, the proper way. That is the four pairs of persons, the eight types of individual. So this is that part of the monastic Sanghas which are Aryans. This is the subset I was talking about. You have faith in the subset of the monastic communities who are Aryans. It is true that sometimes some of the things you see, sometimes if I wasn't a monk, I'd lose my faith in the Sangha. The big Sangha, you know, having money and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. But, you know, there are many, many, many good monks and many, many good nuns. So that's what you have the faith in. Yeah.
You said that sutta is out of context. It didn't contain...
Oh, no.
I thought you said...
Yeah, no, you have to always look at it in context. Looking at one sutta is always out of context. That's why you have to bring in other suttas from other places.
But isn't that sutta all about, like you just said, it's all about the person on the path to stream winner?
Ah, if it's on person on the path of being a stream winner, then this is actually where you make that interpretation. Because at the end here it says... I am a stream enterer, no longer subject to rebirth and lower realm, fixed in destiny, heading for enlightenment. That is, you know, someone who's achieved the fruit of stream winning. Again, stream enterer, stream winning, sometimes that, you know, even the English doesn't make much of a distinction. So, and because they don't make a much of a distinction, it's because in Pali you don't need that distinction. If you're on the path, you know, you're as good as there.
Wouldn't you think that's what the sutra refers to?
Yeah, I hope so, but sometimes people look at that and think, oh, wow, I can do that. I don't need to meditate. I don't need to, you know, to do much. I don't need to actually understand anicca, dukkha, anatta. All I need to do is just to have these precepts, the four pleasant dwellings, the faith, and the good virtue, and then I'm a stream winner.
But it's, as you said elsewhere, it points out you need the jhanas.
Yeah, you do need those as well, yeah. So this is actually where a person knows they're on the path. And it's also one of the things with actually, when it says unwavering confidence. To have unwavering confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, you really do need to have some experience of what the Buddha actually taught. You can have confidence, but to make it unwavering, like a mountain, you've had some great insight. You've really seen something which the Buddha has seen. And that gives you the unwavering part of the faith. Many, many people have faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha. They're called Buddhists. But not all of those, or even many of them, are probably stream winners. But it's the unwavering part, which is another important thing to put your attention on. Yeah, exactly.
But you need to experience for yourself as well.
Indeed, this is the point I was trying to make. that you have to have some experience, a deep experience of the Dhamma. And then, you know, you compare that to what you've heard, say, wow, these nuns know what they're talking about. These monks have seen what I've seen. This Buddha, wow. And there has to be some experience there as well, to give you the unwavering part of the confidence. Anyway, there's another sutta to do, and it's just got the poetry now. When it comes to poetry, and this is a poem they put at the end of this sutta, there's some great advice which I always remember when I learned Pali from the great book by Professor Warder. He said that poetry is meant to inspire. It is not meant to be very clear descriptions of the Dhamma. And I always like to give the simile of one of the English poets, Wordsworth's poems. The opening says, I wandered lonely as a cloud. Now it didn't mean that you were levitating, it didn't mean that you were on drugs. It was a metaphor. And all poetry is like metaphors. And when you try and take a metaphor and to get doctrine out of a metaphor, you're always asking for trouble. So poetry should just be inspirational, not sort of what's the word I was looking for? Something which is dogmatic. Anyway, here we go. Having seen the perils in the hells, one should avoid evil deeds. Having undertaken the noble Dhamma, the wise one should avoid them. That's not the noble Dhamma, that's the evil deeds. To the utmost of one's ability, one should not injure living beings, not knowingly speak falsely, not take what is not given. I like that, to the best of one's ability. One should be content with one's own wives. Not that a man has got many wives these days, but in those days sometimes they would. They were crazy. And that also means that you have to be content with your own husband as well, so to make it gender unspecific. And should refrain from the partners of others. A person not drink wine and liquor or beer, which causes mental confusion, including that drugs. One should recollect the Buddha, ponder on the Dharma. One should develop a benevolent mind, which leads to the world of the heavenly beings. When things to be given are available for one needing or wanting merit, an offering becomes vast if first given to the holy ones. Now that is a dangerous one, as you've heard me say before. Yeah, it is true to give it to the noble ones gives you great merit. But the Buddha even said, and depending in context, it's much better to give it to the whole Sangha than even to a Buddha. I'll just finish the poem then, first of all. I will describe the holy one, Sariputta, listen to me. Among cattle of any sort, whether black, white, red or golden, mottled, uniform or pigeon coloured, the tamed bull is born, that the one that can bear the load, possessing strength, advancing with good speed. They yoke the burden just to him, they are not concerned about his colour. In other words, if you're a good cow, it doesn't matter what colour you are. So too among human beings, it is any kind of caste. The Khatiyas, Brahmins, Wessas, Sudras, Chandalas or scavengers, among people of any sort, the tame person of good manners is born, one firm in Dhamma, virtuous in conduct, truthful in speech, endowed in moral shame, one who has abandoned birth and death, consummate in the spiritual life, with a burden dropped, detached, who has done the task, free of taints, who has gone beyond all things of the world, and by non-clinging has reached Dhamma, non-clinging to a self. An offering is truly vast when planted in that spotless field. So it's actually saying here, just like cattle, whichever cow or bull can actually bear the burden is the best bull. It doesn't really matter what colour. The same as different going against the caste system in India at that time. It doesn't matter where you're from. Fools devoid of understanding, dull-witted, unlearned, do not attend on the holy ones, but give their gifts to those outside. Those, however, who attend on the holy ones, on the wise ones, esteemed as sagely, and those whose faith in the Buddha is deeply rooted and well established, go to the world of the heavenly beings, or are born here in a good family, advancing in successive steps, those wise ones eventually attain Nibbana. So that's a little poem there. So, you had a question? Yeah.
Regarding fools devoid of understanding, dull-witted and unlearned, well, that must be me, because where it says, when things to be given are available for one needing and wanting merit, well, whether I give it or not, I don't depend on am I going to get merit for it. It's irrelevant. I do it because I choose to do so. An offering becomes vast if first given to the holy ones. Now, I've been nomadic now for quite some time, and I bought myself a can of soup on my way from Flockingham to here. And I thought that is going to be a good meal for me because it's got meat and vegetables in it.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking I'm going to have that when I pull up for my rest of the evening. And when I pulled up, I thought, well, I'm obviously not too hungry because I'm too tired. And then I thought, I will have that can of soup for breakfast. When I got up in the morning, I went for a little walk. And along the bicycle ride, curled up around his suitcase was a young African boy, a homeless African boy. And I thought, if that boy is still there, when I pack up my swag, I'm going to give my can of soup to that boy because I was on my way here. I knew I would get a feed here.
Yeah.
So I give the can to the boy. Then last Sunday on my way back along before I got to the cycle path, I come across a homeless lady. She was in about her 60s in a wheelchair with one leg and a cake tin on her lap. And I kept the banana from Dana and I thought, I will have that for my breakfast or my dinner. And then I saw the lady with nothing but some silver in her tin. So I thought, I can't give her the little money that I have. So I give her my banana. So according to this, I'm rather dull-witted because I didn't get to the holy ones first. They, in my mind, I was thinking, is a monk or a nun that desperate that they need a can of soup or a banana when these people have got less than what I have, but I can give to them some sustenance?
Yep. You know? Now, that is a good question. And you know, you'd obviously be praised for doing that rather than if you saw the amount of food we had today. You'd realise that we don't need much more, but it's sometimes we say that that's a band-aid solution. You feed a person for one day and they're hungry again tomorrow. So the question is, and this came very clear to me, that when travelling in India on the holy the pilgrimages, there's so many really, really poor, desperate people over there. And you know, our guide told us very clearly, please do not give anything to the scavengers and poor people. And her woman actually did. She threw some clothes out to this really poor girl. And I was in the bus, and what happened next was just disgusting. Just all the other scavengers came, and they tore and tore at that little dress given to the girl until it was in shreds, and she was bruised and bleeding and crying. You know, because the other people wanted it so badly as well. And instead, you know, all the gifts we had, including money, we gave to a Buddhist temple so that they could look after those kids. You know, give them a sort of an orphanage, a schooling, free health care. Because sometimes it's the way we give those gifts. You know, that it's compassion is there. You did a very compassionate thing. But the wisdom part of it, you know, can we give and make that gift and actually make it so you're not just feeding from the day? If it's to a Salvation Army, to a hostel or some other group, which actually takes in those homeless people and actually gives them counselling, gets them off the drug habits, whatever it is. So that is the best way to do that, Dana.
But if that boy... if that boy were not to make it through one meal, that one meal can make a big difference. It's made a big difference to me when I was 3-4 days without food. And then I was at the Rockingham foreshore, and a family invited me to have a barbecue meal with them.
Yeah, good.
And I did that. With that strength, that extra strength, that physical strength, I came from Rockingham up to here. So that one meal to me has made a very big difference in my life. It's turned me back to the Dhamma.
Exactly, yeah.
So now one meal can help.
It can help, but it's not enough. Because you need to be fed.
The Dhamma's been very good here.
You need to be fed much more than that.
But one meal made me back to
the Dhamma. And it's important to do that as well. So it's not you just don't give any sort of donations or gifts to any other organization. No telephones, no St. Vincent de Paul's, no nothing else. Just give it to the monks and nobody else. That is never what the Buddha was meaning there. What the Buddha was meaning there was that any gift which he has given to a good Sangha, and that Sangha can teach the Dhamma so powerful that it can actually stop people being homeless in the first place. The psychology, the compassion, the wisdom can be so strong that it does save people's lives. So they don't need to live on the streets anymore. So that's one of the things. And eventually that they don't need to get reborn anymore. So that's why it's very powerful. It's not to give to others, but to realize the power of giving when it can. Like to an orphanage rather than to an orphan. Rather than like a food bank rather than just an individual meal. Because they can get much further. Anyway, it's a good question. Yeah?
First of all, I would like to thank you very much to be the good teacher. And because I respect the Lord Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. But in Australia, you wait for 1 year to ordain the monk. But in Thailand, if the good monk do the good deed, I respect. But if they do something like do the drug, drink alcohol or something, I have doubt. I feel no good inside of me. In that case, I will have sin or not. If I would like to donation or do something, I would like prefer to go the monk like your temple or this temple, or if the monk do that, I feel no good. If I will have the sin to criticize or to something like that.
Yeah, that's the other. It's not really pertinent to the talk here, but it is wonderful to be encouraged to criticize a monk at the right time in the right place, and make sure you've got your facts right first of all. Facts right, that you're actually criticizing them for what they really did. Because all the rules of discipline which you find, which monks have to keep, all started because good lay people saw the monks misbehaving and they criticized them. Sometimes the monks didn't realize what they were doing. And they said, that's causing problems, okay, we won't do it anymore. So it is fine, as long as you have a good mind, it's not out of ill will, it's not trying to put somebody down, but trying to do something better for, trying to improve the quality of the Sangha in the future, it's a wonderful thing to do. Your intention is most important. So
but I feel very, very good, like if you can feel it, if the monk that have good feel in the heart, sense it. You feel goosebumps, you can feel like, come to this temple, it's very good. Thank you very much.
I agree. Okay. It's Ajahn Chah's fault. So anyway, I'm just going to go through the next sutta, which is very similar. Then we have the questions from overseas afterwards. This is the Mahanama. It's a similar sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Sakyans in Kapilavatthu, in the banyan tree park, a different place. Then Mahanama, the Sakyan, who was the Buddha's cousin, approached the Blessed One, he was still a lay person, and paid homage to him, sat down to one side and said, "In what way, Bhante, is one a lay follower?" When Mahanama, one has gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha, in that way one is a lay follower. So that today is even going for three refuges, then you can call yourself a Buddhist lay follower. In what way, Bhante, is a lay follower virtuous? When Mahanama, a lay follower, abstains from the destruction of life, taking what is not given, sexual misconduct, from false speech, from liquor and wine and intoxicants, the base for heedlessness, in that way a lay follower is virtuous. That's the five precepts. So you're still a lay follower if you don't keep the five precepts, but you're a virtuous lay follower if you do. So we don't expel people if they don't keep the five precepts. You're still welcome here. So, but it's really a virtual slave follower, you keep the five precepts. When Mahanama, a lay follower, is themselves accomplished in faith but does not encourage others to accomplish faith. Oh, what have we got here? Oh, sorry. In what way, Bhante, is a lay follower practicing for his own welfare but not for the welfare of others? When Mahanama, a lay follower, is themselves accomplished in faith but does not encourage others to accomplish faith? When you yourself are accomplished in virtuous behavior, but you do not encourage others to accomplish virtuous behavior. When you are accomplished in generosity, but you do not encourage others to be generous. When you yourself want to see monks, nuns, but don't encourage others to see monks and nuns. When you yourself want to hear the good Dhamma, but you don't encourage other people to hear good Dhamma. When you yourself retain in mind the teachings you have heard, but don't encourage others to retain the teachings in mind. When you yourself examine the meaning of the teachings that have been retained in mind, but do not encourage others to retain their meaning. When you have understood the meaning and the Dhamma and practice in accordance with the Dhamma, but you don't encourage others to do likewise. In that way, a lay follower is practicing for their own welfare, but not for the welfare of others. So he's making an important point that no person is an island. It's great if you can to encourage other people. And people actually do that. They want their partner, sometimes their kids, to also enjoy the beauty here. If you find a great restaurant, you always want to invite your friends to go to that great restaurant. And so if you are virtuous, it's great to encourage other people to be virtuous as well. That's one of the reasons I keep teaching. And because virtue is important, it's great, and it makes a much better world. So you don't just do it yourself. Sometimes you try and encourage. It's a very difficult thing to do sometimes, but little by little, you know, inviting people to Ajahn Brahm's New Year's Eve party, things like that, is encouraging other people to be virtuous and have a good time without alcohol. And you are generous. You encourage other people to be generous. So that's why, especially the Thai people, next week we're going over to the Nuns' Monastery. They need a new road. So we don't just give a donation ourselves, sometimes we ask our family or friends, people who think can, you know, afford a little bit. This is for a good cause. Would you like to, you know, get a bit here, a bit there? And sometimes you see, you know, whole little people amongst their friends and make a collection. And they're encouraging other people for generosity, which is wonderful. But encouraging other people for generosity doesn't mean you go to the bank with a gun and say, we need to encourage you to give a donation to the Nuns' Monastery. That is not what it's meant here. And now you have the important things about the practice. They say you see good teachers, you hear the good Dhamma, and then you retain in mind the teachings you have heard. In other words, sometimes that you give all these teachings, but how much of it really sinks in? Make sure that things which are really good, you remember, you keep it in mind. And then once you've kept good teachings in mind, then it's up to you to examine the meaning of those teachings, actually to contemplate it, examine it, turn it around, test it out. And that's why we have these classes and why you're allowed to ask questions. I encourage you to examine it until you've understood it. So first of all, you hear it, and then you keep it in mind, then you ponder it, and then you understand it. And also you encourage other people to do the same. And that is how a person... in the last part here, in what way Bhante is a lay follower practicing for their own welfare and for the welfare of others, when Mahanama, a lay follower, are themselves, says herself, accomplished in faith and also encourage others to accomplish faith, accomplishing virtuous behavior and encourages others to do the same, when they're generous, encourage others to be generous, they want to see good teachers and encourage others to see them, they want to hear good teachings, and they encourage others to hear the good Dhamma. And you retain in mind the teachings, you encourage others to keep it in mind. You discuss it with your friends. When you examine the meaning of the teachings, and you encourage others to examine their meaning, and eventually when you've understood the meaning of the Dhamma, and practice it in accordance with the Dhamma, you also encourage others to practice in accordance with the Dhamma. It is in that way Mahanama, the lay follower, is practicing for their own welfare, and also for the welfare of others. So it's making a point which is very rarely made, unfortunately, that your job is to understand these teachings, but also, if they make sense to you, in a skillful way as possible, encourage others to do the same. Which is a beautiful thing to do. And even one of the beautiful things about the Dhamma, it is something which is still practiced in Sri Lanka, not so much in Thailand and Singapore. And it's one of the beautiful things which really inspired me. When anyone does do a donation, or gives some food, or give a robe, they used to have this tradition of like the Katina robe, this big offering. They would pass it around to everybody in the assembly. Everybody would touch it, and they go, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And when they touched it and did sadhu, it was as if they had made the offering as well. And they got as much merit as a person who bought the robe and sewed it and taken it to the temple. It was just wonderful when you... he's just going to get ready for when we're leaving. He hasn't got fed up. He's just... I told him he has to tidy up the room because we're leaving at 4:30. So whenever you encourage other people, you know, to also to share, you know, in your offering, then they get part of the karmic action. And that's such a beautiful thing to do. So it doesn't matter, you know, you come here, you don't have anything to offer to the monks or the nuns for their alms round. You don't need to. Just go in there and you rejoice in other people's offerings. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And that's like you have offered everything as well. That is one of the most beautiful ways of making merit, which is celebrating the other people's merit making. So you get a king comes and gives a whole monastery to somebody, and the king makes merit, but you can't afford that. You just say sadhu, 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 and your heart rejoices in that offering. That is your generosity. You don't need money and things to be generous. And when I heard that, wow, this is great. It's open to everybody, the rich and the poor. So when somebody gives a donation or they give some food or they give a robe and you can't afford it, you don't need to. You just get in there and say, sadhu, can I just touch that? Sadhu. And off you go. You've made huge merit. And I love that little teaching. Because sometimes, you know, you don't have to be rich. You don't have to, you know, have to go out and get all this stuff. Just rejoice in what other people do. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I rejoice in that can of soup which you gave to that homeless one. So I get some of the merit now. Yeah. Very similar, yeah. Yeah. Go on. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yep. 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 Yeah. We did, I can't let that go without saying, our Buddhist Society of West Australia, we were even smarter than that. During the tsunami, we raised money. I forget how many thousands we raised. We sent it to Singapore. Because the Singapore government was saying every $1,000 which a organization in Singapore raised, they would match three times by putting 3,000 in. So we sent our money over to Singapore Buddhist Fellowship. And then the Singapore government did three times that much. And then they sent it over to it was a bit of a scam, but you know, but it worked. And it was for a good cause. So that's what we also did. Which is also good. But it's very good. And it's also good sometimes just sending money sometimes it's not good enough. Because we, you know, here, maybe, I'm surprised people didn't mention it, for years and years and years, we were sending money to an orphanage in Bangladesh. And I think we raised the money over Christmas time. Last year we stopped that, because we found the money wasn't getting to the orphanage. You know, it was a lot of money, because people in Australia are very generous. And a little bit of money is multiplied so many times in a country like Bangladesh. And the person who, you know, our caretaker went to see him once, and another member checked it out. In those days it was all going to the orphanage. But he got greedy and just kept all the money himself. And that was just, ugh. Corruption, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one thing, but when they take the food themselves and give it to their family, that's something totally different. They're sort of actually stealing. So that poor fellow made a lot of really, really bad karma. But so it is much better to be really careful when you make donations to make sure you know where it's going. So now that's why these two over here are counting the donations. You counted the donations this afternoon?
Tomorrow.
Okay, yeah. But you know, we always have two people. It's so many checks and balances. And you can actually see those accounts if you want to, because it's really important to make sure that everybody knows where the donations go to. And also, you can come and check, you know, see how the monks and nuns live. And you don't sort of waste money. That's really important, because otherwise people lose their faith. And that's one of the reasons why charity is so hard in this world. So often you see these cases, you know, you give all this money to poor people over in sort of Syria, and it goes to paying for these big SUVs for these organizations, so their workers can live in five-star hotels, and while people are really poor. And that just, yeah, it's really yucky. And also, please know that any excess food which you give here, when it goes down, it's being loaded into the car, go down to the monastery. That every month, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, we get the local refuge or these other organizations. We come and take all our excess food to give to those people who, even in Australia, fall outside the safety nets. They don't have enough food to eat. So it doesn't go waste. It doesn't rot in the warehouse of Bodhinyana Monastery. It all goes there. But sometimes I tell, so please understand, that's what we do. But sometimes I ask them, please don't come at the time when people are coming to offer these things. Because sometimes people get a bit upset. We gave these to the monks, why are you giving it away? So that's what sometimes people think. But we say, come in later on in the afternoon. So you can, you know, the people actually come and give it. Sometimes they don't see where it goes. It goes to good places, because sometimes they think, no, this is for the monastery, you can't give it away. But that's what we do. Very good. Okay, we do have a couple of questions from overseas, which we'll answer, then we'll finish off. Here we go. From Hawaii, Singapore and USA. How can one sustain continuous 8 precepts as a layperson? This is with great difficulties. Because in the lay world, you know, there's so many temptations to go without listening to entertainment. You go to your mother's house or your father's house, they've got the TV on, they've got radios on. It's very, very difficult. And your mother says, oh, it's Thanksgiving. That's in Hawaii. It's Thanksgiving. You must have something to eat. So sometimes it's really difficult, which is one of the reasons why that if you're a lay person, keep 8 precepts, but not all the time. You can certainly keep it many days a week, but sometimes out of compassion, you know, for your family, just have a meal with them. Look, this is one thing which happened to me, and it wasn't for the 8 precepts. I was a vegetarian when I was a lay person, and I recall just going to my girlfriend's house for dinner, and she forgot I was a vegetarian, and had a really delicious, she put a lot of effort into this meat dish. And I refused to eat it. And that was the end of my relationship with her. And I look back upon that and just how nasty I was to her. And yeah, I was keeping my vow of being a vegetarian, but I was compassionate to animals, but so insensitive to human beings. Now if that happened again, I would just eat that meal, and I would tell her afterwards, delicious meal, but you know, I was a vegetarian. But I ate it first, out of compassion. So sometimes that keeping 8 precepts as a layperson, you know, it's in the wrong vehicle to keep the 8 precepts. You can keep 8 precepts as much as you can, but don't be so strict that if you're with your parents, that you can actually eat something in the evening with them. And obviously the 5 precepts, there's no reason not to keep that as a layperson, but the other ones are very difficult. So my advice is no need to keep them 365 days a year. Maybe, you know, 350 days a year. And there's other 15 days out of compassion for others. Dear Ajahn, this sutra implies 5 precepts applies for stream entry. What training rules are sufficient conditions for experiencing the jhana at will? Now this is one of the points there, that the jhana at will means that you are a non-returner. Where the main obstacles to attaining to the jhanas, which are the basic attachment to the 5 sense world and the 5 senses, that has been overcome. And that's the definition of a non-returner. So it's a non-returner is the person who can get jhanas not at will. And the idea of at will, you know, it's not the will, it's actually whenever you want. It's your default state, which happens when you're not doing anything else. And lastly from USA, what can a person do given their intentions are subjective if their actions are mistakenly led by others, such as saying, no good deeds go unpunished. No good deeds go unpunished. I think what they're actually saying is that sometimes these days one's intentions can be brainwashed. A person, say, who has joined some cult, they are very sincere, they really feel they're doing the right thing, and they may come and up to you and want to convert you into their cult because they really believe their cult is the only way and they're right and other people's are wrong. Their intentions, you know, they're coming from a good place, in a sense of compassion, but not with wisdom. So that is one of the reasons why in Buddhism we always say that kindness, compassion always has to be balanced with wisdom. And just being kind without being wise. Just like that story of that very kind woman who gave a dress to the poor beggar in India. It was kind, but it wasn't wise. And the result of that, her kind action meant that this poor girl was beaten up, and it was one of the nastiest things I've ever seen. So, no good deeds go unpunished. If the good deed is with wisdom and kindness, then it will be rewarded. A good deed without wisdom will be punished. So make sure the good deed has got the kindness and the wisdom there as well. Okay, I did treat those questions from overseas very quickly. I do apologize, but because we're running out of time. So I hope you enjoyed those suttas, and that came from John. If you have any complaints, you can complain to him. Any praise comes to me. If anyone else has suttas they would like me to, or the other monks to read on a Sunday afternoon, please let me know. I'm very happy to do this. So now we can actually pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha with the Buddhang Sawanangacami. Harahangsya.
Arahang. Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhivadami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammaṃ Namassāmi Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi